Okay, let's get started. I'm so glad you guys are here. And let's start with the word of prayer. Heavenly Father, I thank you. I thank you for my friends and extended family in the Lord here that I got to spend time with this week. And I thank you for the encouragement they've been to me. And I hope that all the speakers have been encouragements to them. I pray, Lord, that you'd bless these remaining sessions and continue to feed us, continue to build us up, so that we can go out and better love our neighbors and better serve you in the world. I ask these things in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right. My real title is something more like this: Strange and Surprising Aspects of the Levitical Sacrifices. And you guys are all brave. You saw a title about Leviticus and you came to hear a talk about it. But I hope I'm going to reward you about this. So, who here is familiar with my book, Chosen to Serve? Who here has a copy now? Let's see. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I want to sell at least, 100 copies of that book. It's funny. Free Grace books, people think, man, you guys must make so much money. Someone thought my book made like $30,000, and they're shocked to find out that it's like, no, we sell about like 200 or 300 copies a year, and we're like, yes, that's a success for us. But I think what about our books, the reason why it works for our books is when someone reads a Free Grace book and then they really get it, it's like, you know what I mean? It's like you can read the next Stephen King and you're like, oh, that was a cool story or whatever. But when you read a Free Grace book and it changes your perspective on something, it's like, whoa. And so I think in terms of impact, maybe not in terms of numbers, but in terms of impact, I think our books are making a difference. But I keep a journal kind of not as regularly as I should, but I have a secondary journal. And my secondary journal is that whenever I buy a book and I receive it, I always write a note in the book about what happened that day or what happened that week. Or if I reread a book, I'll put another note on the front the front page, just saying interesting thoughts I've had or things that have happened that week. And I was reading one, and in the hopes that my kids don't dump my books after I die, maybe they'll keep them just as sentimental. Oh, look, it's Dad's journal all through these thousands of books. I don't know. Or maybe some kid in the library might. Seminary in 100 years from now might read that and be like, oh, wow, that's interesting. Why did he reveal that? I don't know. That's weird. I was looking through one of my atonement books, and I noticed a note from 2017, and it said, sent off, chosen to serve to the printer today, starting on my atonement book. And I was like, so I've been working on this thing since 2017, okay? But I am a slow thinker. Anyone else here like a slow thinker? I am so slow. I have to just ponder and think about it and argue with Antonio and then ponder a little bit more and argue with Antonio and then, no. So I've been thinking about the atonement for a long time now, and I have probably 200 or 300 pages of a book, and I feel like I haven't even scratched the surface yet. So probably this thing is going to be, it's probably going to be 1,000 pages, but then the joy of editing is taking that 1,000 pages and then reducing it to something that people actually read, so. The thing that kind of got me thinking about the atonement is that Calvinists and Arminians, you might know this, they debate whether the atonement is limited or unlimited. The Calvinists will say the benefits of the atonement are limited to the elect, and the Arminians will say, well, it was offered to everybody, but only people who meet these other conditions actually enjoy the benefits. Is this familiar to you guys? Pretty much. At a higher level of discussion, evangelicals and others will debate what conceptual model of the atonement best explains how the thing works, how the cross works. And so there's lots of models. Here's just some of them. One is the moral influence theory. Has anyone ever heard of that? If you've been to seminary, you might have heard of it. The moral influence, I'm not even going to talk about these. I'll just summarize it. The moral influence theory is that, well, Jesus dies on the cross to influence us, to teach us to live our own kind of self-sacrificial lives. That's that theory. The ransom theory was that Jesus died on the cross to pay the devil a ransom, securing the release of everyone who is under the devil's bondage. Okay. The satisfaction theory, that's from Anselm, and it was basically God was really he was we besmirched his honor. He was offended. He's offended by sin, and the cross somehow satisfies his offense so that he can be like a happy God again. The Christus Victor theory is that Jesus won a victory at the cross over sin, death, and the devil, and sometimes people add the law. And then penal substitution, which is what evangelicals are mostly familiar with, is the idea that sin had a penalty. Jesus paid that penalty for us in our place so that we can be saved. Those are very oversimplistic descriptions, but you have this idea that, you know, there's all kinds of other theories too. So I'm just thinking about this stuff, all these different debates between Calvinists and Arminians and between evangelicals over these things. And as you guys know, but for anyone who might be watching on YouTube, we belong to the free grace movement, or at least we're trying to build this thing called the free grace movement, where we actually believe that salvation is by faith apart from works. And we actually are, I don't know, I want to say we have the integrity or the bravery. Didn't someone show a quote to that effect? We have the integrity and bravery of actually going to the Bible and trying to follow whatever the Bible happens to say, even if it disagrees with Luther and Calvin and all the traditions that we've been handed down over the last few hundred years. I think Chosen to Serve, my election book, tried to do that. I think I did an okay job on that, and I want to do the same thing for the atonement, because one day it hit me that everybody was assuming, Calvinists and Arminians were assuming, that the benefits of the cross come as a big package. They assumed that, and they were just debating whether it's limited or unlimited. And the people who are thinking about the different conceptual models of the atonement were also assuming that it comes as a big package. And the big package is either Christus Victor or penal substitution or moral satisfaction or whatever. But everyone was assuming that it comes as a package. And so I started just asking the question. I mean, why should we assume that? Is that a good assumption? Is that a biblical assumption? I mean, what if there were two packages? As simple a difference as that, that would just eliminate all of those debates. Maybe there's two packages. One is limited, one's unlimited. What if there's three packages? I don't know. What if they don't come as a package at all? Someone needs to actually read the Bible and try to figure out, is it true that this comes as a package? And so I'm a nerd, so I got excited about that kind of thing. This is my wife, by the way, and she's hanging on for dear life with her coffee. But I'm a nerd, so I think about these things. And in an earlier conference, I did a presentation on the cross, just one aspect of the cross, where I kind of saw that the cross played a role in the war between God and Satan for dominion. And I published it as a journal article called Worthy Terrain, the Cross and the War for Dominion. And I found that very few people wrote about that, but one guy kind of did. R.B. Thieme, does anyone know R.B. Thieme? I like R.B. Thieme. I find him very profitable to read. I read. I don't really listen to him so much. I read his stuff. But that's a whole aspect of the cross that most books on the atonement didn't even touch. That there's this angelic conflict. Have you ever heard of that term, angelic conflict? This war between God and Satan and his minions, and they're warring over dominion for the earth. And in Revelation, there's this pivotal passage where Jesus, the slain lamb, is found to be worthy to open these scrolls, and he's found worthy to reign. If you read a typical evangelical book on the atonement, they don't even believe, they don't even believe in that type of eschatology, so they totally miss all of that information, and it doesn't get into their books. And so I think that's part of the overall picture of what the cross is doing. But there's so much more. And so I decided to just start from the beginning, go to the Old Testament, and actually kind of just go through the evidence slowly. And I'm starting with Levitical sacrifices. And I found that of the 43 books or so, and I'm getting more every week, as Abby can attest, as my mailman can attest, I found that only three of the 43 books that are only devoted to the atonement, that's not including systematic theologies and not including commentaries, that's different, only three referred to the Levitical sacrifices that had at least half a page. And only one devoted at least five pages to Levitical sacrifices. And that was by Leon Morrison. It's an excellent book. But I found that, wow, what are people doing? When you think of the cross, he's the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, right? That has a history. So you need to look at the history in the Bible to understand what that symbol means or what that language means, I would think. Does that make sense to anyone else? Apparently that didn't make sense to at least 42 authors of the Atonement. And I found this quote from an Old Testament scholar named Margaret Barker, and she says, there's recently been a number of books on the Christian understanding of Atonement, and what's been fascinating for me is the extent to which these books do, or more often do not, use the Old Testament material on Atonement as the basis for what they have to say. And she goes on to just note, man, it's like this is Old Testament language. These are people thinking in Old Testament terms. How could you understand what they're saying in the New Testament without at least trying to delve into their cultural background and their you know, the earlier parts of Scripture? Does that make sense to anyone? So I don't know. I think maybe it's because we're free grace. A lot of these Atonement books, by the way, are, guess what they're about? Do you think they're about the Bible? I would say maybe half are about the Bible, but what do you think they're really about? The Westminster Confession. What did Calvin believe? What did Luther believe? I have this 1,000-page book by an author I really love. It's on the Atonement, and I thought this is going to be great because this guy is free grace friendly, and it's all about Baptists fighting with each other, basically. Arminian and Calvinist Baptists. And I'm like, well, this is useless to me. I just spent like $60 on this book, and no, I'm a Baptist. I mean, listen, I'm a Baptist, reluctantly, but I'm a Baptist. I haven't found any other better home, but useless, because I want to know what the Bible says. That's kind of what the free grace movement is all about. And I'm just talking your ear off about all these preliminary things, but all right, so these are the offerings, and I am not going to go through all of them. What I'm going to do instead is this. I'm just going to give you some surprising ideas that I've come across so far. I really only have a really good first draft on the burnt offering, and it's like, it's maybe 30 or 40 pages just on that one offering, but I'm not going to go over the burnt offering. I'm just going to go over some surprising and just interesting ideas that I've come across so far in my studies. I have not checked these things out as thoroughly as I'd like to. Again, I am slow, so I'm like, I want to see all the sources. And I used to give plasma just so I can buy the books, because it was getting to be a problem. And so Abby was like, listen, you can buy books, but not on our money. It's got to be blood money. It's got to be my blood money books. So these are just things that sparked my imagination. And Do you know we need a biblical imagination? You need imagination to just kind of break out of your traditions and just read the Bible afresh sometimes. You just have to, you know, get out of your Baptist square, get out of your whatever, the box, and just have a little bit of imagination to think about what the Bible's really about. So the first thing I was really surprised with is that atonement does not mean to cover. I grew up with the idea, or I've heard so many people say, that the Hebrew word for atonement means to cover. And the Old Testament, the sacrifices only cover, but the cross actually totally removes sin. Did anyone come? Everyone heard that? I've heard that over and over and over again. It never really made sense to me because the English word atonement means at one minute. It doesn't mean to cover. So who came up with this idea that it means to cover? It turns out it was an idea from a few decades ago, and that some preachers just thought, that'll preach. That'll preach. And so it just got repeated and repeated and repeated. But apparently, it turns out, that they've known at least since the 80s and 90s that that is not true. Someone just made a mistake. So the reason why that's important is because Leviticus is really about atonement. For example, and he shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering so that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. So the question is, what does this word atonement mean? And Alan Ross, DTS guy, in his commentary on Leviticus, he kind of summarizes it for the preachers nowadays. He says, it now seems likely that there were two words, and yes, they had the same consonants, but they made the mistake of thinking that means the meaning of the one word should be imported into the meaning of the second word. And think of it like this. It's kind of like, what would be an example of that? It'd be like, hair and hare the rabbit. All right, same consonants. And if someone said, oh man, English people thought that they had rabbits on their head because hare means rabbit. And they use the word hair for their hair on their head. And so that means people thought, you know what I mean? So apparently they made that mistake of thinking that this one word, which does mean to cover, should be imported into this other word, which means to atone. And so ever since, for decades, preachers were preaching that, hey, atonement means just to cover. Apparently that's not true. As Alan Ross and other people point out, no, it says in Leviticus that these guys were forgiven. Not that they were almost forgiven. It says that they were forgiven. And we need to take that seriously. Gordon Wenham, so what does the word mean? By the way, this is like probably like 10 pages in my chapter going into just proving it. Because I was like, what? You can't just say that we've all been mistaken and not prove it. So I've been going through all the journal articles and all the lexicons showing that. But anyways, I'm just presenting it very simply now. So what does atonement mean? Gordon Wenham puts it this way. To make atonement has two different meanings in Hebrew. To wipe clean or to pay a ransom. Doesn't mean to cover. That's another word. It means to wipe clean or to pay a ransom. So that was kind of interesting because that was shocking because I'd heard that it meant to cover. The second biggest issue that I was confronted with in studying this is the commentators point out that there's this tension in Leviticus and there's a huge debate among them, but what is the core issue? What are the sacrifices trying to attain? Is the issue morality or is the issue impurity? I should say, is it personal, individual morality or is it impurity? And I was like, this was very kind of fascinating to me. Philip Jensen remarks, and he was writing this before COVID, but he says, the concern for purity and impurity is largely foreign to Western culture, which tends to emphasize the categories of sin and guilt. I say before COVID because since COVID, we're kind of obsessed with purity and impurity, right? It's like, you touch that, I don't want to, you know, it's like, you want to just clean everything. Or not this group, but other groups. I mean, some people, my own neighborhood, people walking alone on the street with a mask on. And, you know, it's like, you're okay, you don't need that. You're alone. Or people driving in their car with the mask on alone. It's like, you don't... Impurity, it's like this impurity obsession. But anthropologists, he says, have shown that this is really big in most cultures, and it was definitely big in biblical culture. Leviticus 4, and people have missed this. Leviticus 4 has what's often called the sin offering, but I found that most commentators say, and even evangelical ones, say, ah, yeah, that was a mistake. It shouldn't have been called that. It should have been called the purification offering. Because really the issue is decontamination of the sacred space. This was really interesting to me because we have this language. He says it really means to cleanse, purify, decontaminate. In Psalm 51:7, cleanse me with hyssop and I will be clean. Now when you think about that, we have all repeated those words, right? Cleanse me with hyssop so I can be clean. And what have we thought? We have thought that it was individualistic, moralistic, and this has to do with my guilt, right? We've just assumed, oh, he's using clean language, but it really has to do with my moral guilt. But what these guys say is, no, they were actually really concerned with the way that sin contaminates you. The way that sin makes something, a space, impure. And there's all kinds of material on this. And they also point out that the object of the cleansing with the blood is supposed to make things pure. The object of the cleansing is usually, not the person. It's not like you're getting covered with blood so that you're cleansed of your impurities. Where does the blood go? Where does the blood get applied to? Do you guys know? It's the altar, or the sides of the altar, or the entrance of the altar, or to the Holy of Holies. The blood is applied to the sacred objects within the tabernacle to cleanse them, because they've become impure. And so that's a totally different... We were thinking Levitical sacrifices, this is all about me, I sinned, I'm bad, I have guilt, and so I need to be cleansed. And really, Leviticus is the opposite. No, it admits, yeah, you're a sinner, but guess what? You contaminated the sacred space. And so we need to decontaminate and purify sacred space so that God's presence can still be here. Do you see that that's a totally different focus than like individual evangelical type approaches to these things? And so that kind of sparked my imagination. And by the way, so Leviticus goes into this very, all these details about the different procedures, like it's like in God's sacred space, there's what is the kind of most sacred of everything in the tabernacle, let's say. What is it called? The Holy of Holies, you know that. And then there's the outer chamber, and then there's the outside of the tent in the courtyard, and then there's the space between the entrance to the meeting to the altar. There's all these kind of like different spaces, and each of those spaces require different procedures in order to decontaminate and purify them. This is totally weird to us, right? Because the temple and tabernacle don't exist anymore, so it's easy to just forget. And we don't even like reading Leviticus because it has all this stuff that has, we think, it has nothing to do with us. And so we end up reading the New Testament and we totally ignore the context, their thought pattern. And so here, to spark my imagination, and I want to spark your imagination, do the New Testament writers ever speak about the benefits of the cross in terms of a cleansing? What about 1 John 1:9? So what do they mean? If in the Old Testament it meant you're being decontaminated so that you can be in the presence of God, so God can remain in the presence of Israel, what does 1 John 1:9, what would that mean if they're thinking that sin pollutes and you need to be decontaminated? We don't have a temple nowadays. We don't have a tabernacle nowadays. Or do we? Who's the temple now? We are. So why might the blood need to be applied to the temple to decontaminate the space so that God's presence can be there? Does that spark your imagination about maybe thinking about the benefits of the cross personally is maybe a little bit different than what we've inherited as evangelicals, where it's just strictly about, you know, moral purity and guilt? What if we have to think about it in terms of us being, we're the temple, individually but also corporately, and God's presence is within us, and that presence had, that temple had to be prepared for His presence. So it needed to be cleansed with blood. I am not making any conclusions here. I'm just sharing with you my thought pattern as I'm thinking through this slowly, okay? I just thought that's one example of just something I'm like, man, I need to think that. Or what about Jesus when he's talking about, he's with the disciples and he washes their feet. And do you remember what he says about all the disciples except with one exception? Do you remember what he says? You are all clean except one of you. And so, but you need to keep doing this. Well, what did Jesus mean? What did he mean? And it's really interesting, just a little while later, what does Jesus do? He breathes the Holy Spirit into them. What does that mean? Cleansing, this idea of purity. Very interesting. And oh, by the way, and I wonder, you know, we often say that, you know, you are clean means you're forgiven. And it could be mean that. But if it does mean you're forgiven, then you have a one-time forgiveness in John's gospel. All right, God's pleasure. Another thing I've noticed is we are so self-centered in our reading of the Bible. We just think it's us, the benefit. How does this benefit me? What does this have to do with me? I want to know what the cross does for me. And one of the things you see in Leviticus is all of these things really are often for God. And the priest shall offer all of it up in the smoke on the altar as a burnt offering, an offering by fire, as a soothing aroma to who? To the Lord. I want to make sure. Okay, 950. So this sacrifice actually, who does it benefit? It benefits God. So that opens up a question. The way I'm trying to approach these materials is by asking three questions. What is the benefit? Let's identify the benefits. Who is the beneficiary? Who gets the benefits? And what's the condition for getting the benefit? Well, what I found is some of the benefits of these sacrifices are not us, it's for God. And that just kind of made me think about, well, what other benefits? Maybe there are two packages. At least, maybe there's a package of benefits for people, and maybe there's a package of benefits for God. Or again, maybe there is not a package of benefits. Maybe it's all separated. I don't know. I'm still trying to find that out. I don't want to assume anything. But in this case, the benefit is for God, which raises the question, what other benefits are for God? And Hartley says in his Leviticus commentary, the pleasant, soothing odor of the sacrifice that ascends towards heaven pleases God. And while this metaphor is anthropomorphic, I'm not quite sure why he says that. I think he thinks that God is not able to smell. But is that a good assumption? I don't know. I like to think that God can, well, I mean, in the incarnation, God can definitely smell. In his theophanies, he partook of things. Is it a safe thing to say that God can't smell? I don't know. I wouldn't make that assumption. It is no more so than numerous other phrases in the Old Testament, such as the hand of God. The sacrifice is offered in order to move God to remember with mercy the one who makes the sacrifice. This is interesting, too. Usually a whole burnt offering was presented not to cool God's wrath, although sometimes I think it does. God's wrath is a big part of this. But to seek his goodwill before his wrath might be kindled. So it's like you do a sacrifice, some of these sacrifices, it's not because you've done anything wrong. You've done something to please the Lord in order to avoid his future wrath. So it's kind of like a proactive move on your part. And it made me think. In the New Testament, does God ever mention his pleasure with the cross? Do the New Testament writers ever talk about making pleasing sacrifices to God? Right? And how does that please or affect? That's a whole other question. How does it please or affect God? Is it just to like make him go from being angry to more kindly disposed towards you? Is it to kind of help him remember you? This is what seems to be some of the Levitical kind of themes. How does it affect him? These are just questions I need to ask that I just don't see them in atonement books. Okay? But these are questions I feel like we just absolutely need to ask. Preemptive ransom. This is going a little bit outside of Leviticus, but it was just kind of a bunny trail from Leviticus. But here's an example of something else you can do for God. And you shall take the atonement money from the sons of Israel and give it to the service of the tent of the meeting so that it may be a memorial for the sons of Israel before the Lord to make atonement for yourselves. So you're doing something. You're making an offering. This time it's not a sacrifice. It's a money offering. But you're doing it so that God will remember you. And it also makes this atonement for yourselves. But this is what's interesting about this. In that case, there was no harm, there was no negligence, there was no sin involved in that offering. What's happening is you're making a proactive payment to God so that he will remember you, so that you will not suffer wrath in the future. So it's like you're not repairing anything, you're just giving him an offering so that you won't get wrath in the future. He'll be pleased with it, and you will, any future wrath coming, you'll avoid that because of this offering that you've made. So that's one benefit that appears in the Old Testament. And I wonder, does it ever appear in the New Testament? Does the New Testament ever talk about a cross as a payment or a ransom that results in us avoiding future plagues or wrath? Is there a future wrath that's coming that the church gets to be exempt from? Because we're under... Do you see how this might spark your imagination a little bit? And by the way, do you think those 42... Maybe all 43, I don't know. Atonement books, do you think... How many of those guys do you think believe in, like, the tribulation and rapture? And very few. Very few, right? Because they're mostly Anglican and Presbyterian and Lutheran and... But this is just kind of making me think about, okay, well, what other benefits does the... No one ever talks about a benefit of the cross being like the rapture and exemption from tribulation or whatnot. And I'm not saying that's the case in the New Testament. I'm just saying this is what I'm thinking about, okay? I'm just like, I wonder, I have these questions. Rejecting the remedy. I'm running out of time, but this was reading between the lines. There is a sacrifice for unintentional sins. but not for sins of the high hand. Really, there were no, it's hard to tell if there are any sacrifices for sins of the high hand. That's a huge debate. But unintentional sins are often non-moral purity issues, such as having a baby, a discharge. And I agree, having a baby, that's so gross. No, a discharge touch. I always say, people are always like, babies are so cute, and they look like lizard meat to me. Like it takes them a few months to plump up, but whenever I tell people, and it's the truth, my truth, but I feel like women are just hardwired to look at a little baby and just think, man, these are just so cute because you just put in tons of effort to like get this baby. But the guys are like, oh man, I need to come back in a few months while they plumped up. Sorry, babe. It's true. I mean, okay. Touching a dead body, getting a skin disease, all these things. These are unintentional sins. And you're able to offer a sacrifice for that. But it's interesting the way this is phrased. Now, if the entire congregation of Israel does wrong unintentionally, and again, these are non-moral things that you might, you know, you accidentally brushed a dead body, or you have a skin rash on your back that you don't even know about, escapes the notice of the assembly, and they commit any of these things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and they become guilty. So if this is true of you, you have become guilty. But a second thing has to happen before you can bring this remedy. When the sin which they have committed becomes known, it has to become known to you. If you do an unintentional sin, you might realize it later, but you might not. And it's interesting reading these rabbis. What they say is, well, what happens at that point? Let's say you've committed the unintentional sin and you never know it. And no one ever tells you. You never realize it. You're in a state of guilt. But what's going to happen to you? And they're reading between the lines and they're saying it looks like there is no punishment for an unintentional sin. The punishment comes in at this second step. Once it becomes known, then you're obligated to bring this offering. And that means you can refuse to do that. And so what happens is, the greater offense is not the unintentional sin, what these rabbis say. The greater offense is knowing you should bring the remedy and rejecting the remedy. Because that becomes an intentional sin. That becomes a sin of the high hand. They're reading between the lines here, but are you following what I'm saying? And so that made me think about this. Oh, and there's different processes for priests, rulers, and peoples, indicating the different levels of breaches of impurity. And again, back to this purity, impurity, and it's the more important you are, the greater impurity your unintentional sin creates in the sacred space. And I won't get into that. But anyways, commentators note the real disobedience is not the unintentional sin, but rejecting the remedy. And that made me think, do the New Testament writers ever think about rejecting the remedy as being the greater offense than the original sin that required the remedy in the first place? That just made me think about, are we all thinking about the same thing? What is the issue at the Great White Throne Judgment? It's rejecting the remedy. That's the issue. That just made me think about that. I don't know. That's where my imagination is going. But it's in there. And guess what? Most of those atonement books that I have, I don't think they get the Great White Throne Judgment right. First of all, their eschatology is all wrong. But I also think they don't understand the standards of what's happening there. But maybe if they kind of had these ideas that, yeah, rejecting the remedy can be a greater offense than the sin itself, maybe you'd pick that up. I don't know. Okay, this one totally freaked me out. We have 5 minutes and I'm able to just end with this. This was really shocking to me. There is this, in the Day of the Atonement, we have totally sanitized our translation, and it's because of William Tyndale. We have this term called the scapegoat. Who's heard of the scapegoat? Right? Tyndale totally invented that terminology. In the Hebrew, it's actually a personal name named Azazel. And if you read I never studied Leviticus before because it's Leviticus and I didn't want to study it. It's like I have other things, you know. But when I was reading this, I didn't realize all the commentators say this. They're like, yeah, everyone's talking about scapegoat, but what it says is Azazel. And Azazel was a demon. And so what the verse actually says in the ESV, kudos to the ESV for getting this right. It actually says, Aaron shall cast lots over the two goats, one for the Lord and the other for Azazel. And so the commentators are like, we know that Azazel in all this tradition was a demon of the wilderness, which later became identified with Satan. And so what is going on here? In our sanitized evangelical preaching, we don't like talking about demons or anything like that. Unless you're charismatic, then kudos for you, because you'll probably talk about that. But for us Baptists, we don't like touching this type of stuff. And we don't like thinking of the Day of the Atonement has a goat for God, or has a sacrifice for God, and it doesn't have a sacrifice for Azazel. It sends the goat off to Azazel. And do you remember what happens to the second goat? He puts both hands on the goat, and then what happens? The sins get transferred onto the goat, right? And then the goat gets sent off to Azazel. Michael Heiser explains this in his book. He kind of summarizes it in, what is it called? The Unseen Realm, I think. I don't know, maybe, probably, yeah, I don't have that book. I'm going to have to add that to my list, babe, so I'll have to give some more blood. It's a proper name in Leviticus 16. One goes for Yahweh, one for Azazel. Anyways, and you can read it about it in any contemporary commentary on Leviticus, you can read about it. But Milgram makes a point of saying they are not sacrificing a goat to a demon. They are making no sacrifices to the demon. What's happening is sin is being transferred to the animal and is being sent off to what they think of as demonic places to a demon. Saying here, it's basically saying, Here's the sin. Take, you want this sin? You like this sin? Here, have it back. We're casting it out of the sacred space. So the sin gets transferred, it gets banished, and then it gets sent off to the demonic places, which is what Azazel represents and what the wilderness represents. And as my last thought, I have a few more, but I'm just going to end with this. As my last thought, do the New Testament writers ever talk about sin being moved from off of us onto something else, and then maybe banished to the place of demons eventually? Do they ever talk about sin being banished to an underworld or to a demonic realm? I immediately thought of the lake of fire. Hades is cast, death is cast, and it's all cast into there. It's not erased, it's not annihilated. It's like sin doesn't disappear, it gets cast away, banished into the realm of demons. I found that really exciting. I'm a nerd. I get it. But I was like, what? That is so weird. But my motto is, keep the Bible weird. Just keep it weird. Let it be weird. Because I am so rationalistic. I'm so Western. I'm so modern. But I want a biblical worldview. And at the very least, I want to enter into their worldview and try to understand what they're saying. And I don't want to impose my categories on them. And so the New Testament writers are thinking about sin being transferred from one place to another and then banished. I want to understand that so I can, you know the truth instead of knowing my traditions. Do you understand? Are you with me with that? Who thinks this is weird, by the way? This is extremely strange. Extremely strange. All right, let me just, I'll have to skip that. All right, well, my research plan is basically to go through the patriarchs, go through the Levitical sacrifices, that's where I'm starting, go through the feasts, then the prophets, then the Psalms and historical writings. And once all that is done, then go to the New Testament and try to figure out what's going on there. So thank you very much for taking the risk and attending this meeting. Appreciate it.